Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's no surprise that rats thrive in cities, but our guest tells us warmer weather is part of the reason behind a spike in rat populations around the United States.
First, the Assembly passed the Wisconsin state budget 2 months after the deadline. Lawmakers debated the latest version of the bill for 11 hours before passing it late last night.
The $76 billion bill had been hung up on issues like transportation and school funding, but while the Assembly passed the budget last night, it's not a done deal just yet.
Jesse Appoint is with us to talk about the budget that passed last night and the latest on the Foxconn incentive package. She's a reporter for the Capital Times, where she covers politics and government. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon.
Well, before we get to that budget, some news this afternoon. The Assembly now has passed the amended Foxconn incentive package bill today. What happens next?
Next, it goes to Governor Walker's desk, and he said he'd like to sign it soon. From there, they can start negotiating the contract and setting things in motion.
Do we have any idea what the timeline and that kind of negotiation could be?
Not really, other than part of the conditions for the memorandum of understanding that they initially signed was this needed to go through the legislature by the end of the month, by September 30th. So, you know, they're giving themselves a little bit of a cushion on that. But but I guess by that knowledge, we know that they want to move quickly, but we don't have a lot of specifics.
I guess it's hard to map it out. This is, at least in scale, pretty unprecedented for Wisconsin.
It is, yeah. It definitely is unprecedented.
Let's move on now to the state budget, passing the Assembly now last night. How did the vote go down? What was the margin? Any crossovers between parties?
Yeah, a little bit of crossover, and they're usually, well, Not crossover from the Democratic side. Every Democrat voted against it, and that was not a surprise. They made pretty clear that would be the case. But there were a handful of Republicans who voted against it, a lot of them from sort of the suburban areas around Milwaukee, some pretty conservative districts, and a lawmaker from more northern Wisconsin, too.
What were the reasons Republicans gave for voting against the budget?
A lot of the reasons that we saw Republicans voting against the budget in the Assembly last night kind of jibe with what we're seeing in the Senate right now, which is playing out a little bit more dramatically. You know, in the Assembly, there's a pretty strong Republican margin majority that allows you to lose a couple of those votes. So, you know, there's objections to things like just the level of spending in general. But then we get into some more specific things like there's a full repeal of prevailing wage in the budget. Some lawmakers want to see that go into effect earlier. Some of them, you know, the budget does expand the state voucher program for schools, but they would like to see that expanded more. And then there's some things within transportation. You know, we know transportation has been part of the holdup, well, really the main holdup, and the reason why this budget is coming in more than 2 months late. And so there's still some disagreement over what ended up being approved in that transportation package. People want to see more reforms implemented within DOT, you know, more restrictions on when communities can pass referendums. So everyone kind of has their specific little wish list items, things that they wish would have gotten in, but for that handful of legislators, it was enough to have them vote against it.
As you mentioned, all Democrats in the Assembly voted against the budget. I understand the key word for the day for Democrats was rigged. What were they saying about this Republican budget plan?
They were very much on message. Rigged was the word of the day last night, and again, actually today during the Foxconn debate. But yeah, you know, there's some debate over how much Democrats disliked the budget. At least for some Republicans tried to suggest that maybe they didn't actually think it was that bad, and they were just doing their partisan job. But you know, the biggest concern, I think, was the lack of a long-term transportation solution, and that is something that Republicans really agreed on, actually, with Democrats. But then, you know, things with schools, this budget does include a relatively substantive increase in schools funding, but it's coming after, you know, years of either holding it flat or little bit smaller increases, and The state level of support is still lower than it was 10 years ago, so Democrats are unhappy with that. They're unhappy seeing that happen in conjunction with the expansion of the voucher program, which, of course, most of them are pretty strongly opposed to.
We're talking to Jesse Apoyan from the Capital Times about the latest on the state budget. A version of that budget passed the Assembly, now the Senate. And Jesse, let's talk about that. We've been hearing from Senate Republican leaders as of very recently. They don't quite have the votes to pass it. What are we hearing from Republican holdouts in the Senate?
Yeah, so they do not have the votes yet. As of this afternoon, they are scheduled to take it up at 9:30 tomorrow morning. We'll see who comes along. So the list of some of the things that we mentioned earlier, in terms of the DOT reforms, there have been a pretty long list of proposals introduced throughout this process, and some of the senators are hoping to see a couple of those make their way in. One of them being, not allowing cities to impose a wheel tax unless they do so through a referendum. They want to move the budget would have the prevailing wage repeal take effect in September of 2018. These senators want to see that moved up to January 1st. And Governor Walker did indicate that he would be supportive of that, but we'll see. I guess they'd like to see the expansion of the voucher program. They'd like to see a larger increase in the income limit on that. And an interesting one is they want to, or at least one senator in particular, I think, wants to prohibit the UW system from spending money on diversity training. As far as I know, that's not a mandatory training, but that's something that they don't want state dollars going to.
Yeah, I understand the language said neither mandatory nor voluntary diversity training could use state money, something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly, yeah.
And now Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, they've passed their budget, and he says, we're not going to be held hostage. He used the word hostage by these Republican senators. So there's a bit of drama and conflict again between Republican Assembly leadership and some in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, just when we thought everyone was coming together in agreement, apparently not so fast. But it sounds like he's choosing his words carefully. He said last night they will not be coming back next week. But if the Senate makes changes to the budget, that has to be reconciled with the Assembly. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, he said the time has come and gone for negotiations. We've had months to do this, and the joint finance process has worked its way through. It's gone through the committee the way it always does and the way it's supposed to, and now's not the time to start negotiating.
But we're 2 months late on the budget. If those Republican senators don't back down on their end and Assembly Speaker Voss says we're not coming back on this, then what?
Then we wait and see who blinks first.
And I heard, I think you tweeted, actually, that there was talk of taking the budget through tomorrow and maybe having a Saturday meeting, always enjoyable for Capitol reporters, I know. Is there going to be some overtime work to try to get this done?
It's very possible. I think it really depends on what they can do in the next 12 to 24 hours. If they can get, they're set to come in at 9:30 tomorrow morning. If they can get started and get moving and make some headway, then they can certainly get it done in a day, but if it takes that long to convince people to come aboard, then we may see ourselves going into the weekend or, potentially next week.
And you also tweeted on a related or kind of unrelated note, Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca will no longer be Assembly Minority Leader. There are kind of different stories about what happened in the Democratic caucus, but there was kind of an emotional farewell from his Republican counterparts. What happened?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, So Representative Barca will be stepping down from the minority leader post at the end of the month. And so if the Assembly doesn't come back, as they said they won't, this was his last day on the floor as the Democratic leader. Yeah, Speaker Robin Voss gave a touching tribute. He talked about they came in and started working together sort of in the post-Act 10 era and talked about the importance of finding compromise and bipartisanship and having civil discourse, respecting the institution and finding ways to do that through the different agreements that they've come to over the years, and sort of just the hope that they will continue that and be able to look, of course they have their policy agreements, but the hope is that they can continue to both have both sides respect each other and at the end of the day have that civil debate.
And there was something about a jersey and a bet with a town in Ohio. What was the story there?
Well, there was a bet with between Speaker Voss and the Speaker of the Ohio House. Speaker Voss had to wear the opposing team's jersey. He came in wearing that, and in a very dramatic moment, Representative Barca came up, removed the jersey, threw it off, and there was a Badgers jersey underneath the whole time.
All right, Jesse, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on that, and you know, that budget thing, too.
And that thing, too.
That's Jesse Apoyan, a reporter for the Capital Times, where she covers politics and government. She joined us today to talk about the latest on the state budget. It passed the Assembly now, still not a done deal in the state Senate. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
If you're seeing more rats than you're used to, there's a reason why. Rat numbers are on the rise around the country. Cities like New York, Houston, and many others are seeing a spike in the number of these rodents this year.
And in Chicago, rodent complaints for the early part of summer have increased about 9% from the previous year. According to our next guest, that's for city officials to start sprinkling the streets with rat birth control.
Emily Atkin is a staff writer at the New Republic. She wrote the recent piece, America is on the Verge of a Ratpocalypse. She joins us to explain what's behind the rise in the rat population and what can be done about it. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is behind this increase in the number of rats in a lot of places around the country?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons why we're seeing an increase in rats in cities across the country. One reason is just simply because we're seeing more people in cities, and more people bring the best habitat for a rat. Rats love people because people have food, and they have warm houses, and they have garbage. And so as we pack more people into cities, more rats are thriving in those areas. The other reason, which I talk about a lot in the piece, is that we're seeing warmer winters becoming more common. And rats like breeding when it's warmer outside. They stop breeding in the winter. So when we see warmer winters across the country, we see rats squeezing in one or two more litters. And as I talk about in the piece, one or two more litters of rats can be an extreme problem in increasing the number across the city.
Right. The math is not on our side here. You wrote that one pair of rats in ideal conditions can, over a few years, create a population of, what was it, hundreds of thousands? Do I have that right?
Actually, okay. This was the one line in the piece that I think freaked the most people out. It was a stat I got from a rat control company that said that two rats in an ideal environment can breed into 482 million rats.
I'm sorry.
over a period of 3 years. Yeah, so that's, you know, two rats turn into 10, then those turn into 100, because the rats, the litters are big, right? And they breed and have babies really quickly. So if they're in two rats in an ideal environment over a period of 3 years, can turn into 482 million rats.
Well, let's not try to think about that part too much, I guess. But when a city or a community is dealing with a rat problem, is it possible to get a real handle on the numbers of rats? It's hard to do a rat census, I would imagine.
Oh, it's so hard. And if you talk to rodentologists, which I did in this piece, and figured out that rodentologists are a thing that exists, they'll tell you that rats are super elusive. They live underground. They live in infrastructure. They live in garbage cans. They live everywhere. It's so hard to study rats and even the diseases that they spread. So we don't have a great handle on how many we have, but we can track how much we can get a good idea based on the amount of complaints that people lodge, based on the number of sightings that people report, and based on the number of violations in a city, like in restaurants.
Is this just a big city problem, or do we see this in suburban areas, I don't know, rural areas as well?
This is mainly a big city problem. Obviously, rats will exist anywhere that humans live, but when we're talking about influxes, I mean, unless you're going to eradicate the whole species, which is not going to happen, or I don't think anyone wants that to happen. The big problem is huge populations in dense urban areas where people can unknowingly come into contact with either the rats or their urine or fecal matter. And that's where we see illnesses. Almost always when we see illnesses that can be traced to rodents, it's in a big city.
And that's the big problem here. It's not just the ick factor. This is a public health concern, right?
Yeah, that's the two things that are what we're really concerned about is public health and the economic impact of rats, because rats can damage infrastructure, which we could get into later. But yeah, public health is a huge problem because rats carry diseases. They carry E. coli, salmonella, and other viruses that are kind of awful, more awful, like Solhanta virus, which can cause an Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever. And that's, that's really rare. But also with the science, like, it's hard to say how many rats there are. It's also hard to say if you have a rodent-borne disease, whether or not that disease actually came from a rodent, because a lot of people just don't know if they've been in contact with a rat. So sometimes you'll feel bad. You'll feel like you've got the flu or something, and doctors will just treat it like a flu. They won't ask you where you got it, and you won't know that you might have gotten it from getting into contact with, fecal matter from a rat.
We're talking about a growth in the rat population around the country. Emily Atkin is with us. She wrote about this in the New Republic. Emily, you talked with someone known as the Rat Czar, Bobby Corrigan. Tell us a little bit about him and his work.
Well, I learned about Bobby Corrigan because he is just the guy that's quoted in every single piece about rats. I think, he might be the most well-respected rodentologist in the country, and he travels the world to help cities deal with their very unique rat problems, because every city's rat problem is different. They have different infrastructure, they have different, subway systems, and they have different reasons why rats are thriving. So he goes and he consults cities across the world about their rat problems. He's the one that said, anecdotally, that I see this everywhere, over the last few decades that he's been doing this, it's worse than it's ever been. But he's not only, he's not only somebody that consults about getting rats in cities. He's somebody, is that he's somebody that really respects the rat as a very intelligent animal. And, he told me a few times, it's just one of the most impressive mammals in terms of their ability to survive that he's seen. And so I gained an appreciation of the rat by talking to him.
Let's get into some solutions. What are some of the ways cities and states, first of all, are trying to tackle the growing rat problem?
Yeah. New York City is doing a big rat program right now. Mayor Bill de Blasio just announced like a $32 million, I think, program to get the rat problem in New York under control. If you've ever been to New York, I don't need to tell you about it. Mm-hmm. You've seen it. It's one of the worst cities for rat problems. And so that involves improving waste management, right? Rats love trash. You got to pick up trash more. You got to ramp up enforcement for places, grocery stores, restaurants that are leaving out food and letting rats get in. You got to ramp up penalties. You got to perhaps put rat poison around. But the issue with rats is that they evolve to become resistant to rat poisons, which is why you're seeing birth control being spread, rat birth control being spread around instead of rat poison, which is really interesting. But the other thing is that you just need a good amount of money to be able to improve infrastructure everywhere. And what Bobby Corrigan told me is that cities don't take rats seriously enough generally, and they underestimate their ability to survive to invest enough money into rat eradication programs. And just generally, cities don't have enough money.
and you write about the possible federal role that we that there used to be a big RAT program. We don't have that anymore. Talk about that.
Yeah, we used to have, from 1969 to 1982, the CDC had a big program where they awarded grants to different cities so that they could, you know, put in place rodent control programs. You know, the cities would fund their own programs, but then they would get a boost from the federal government. And CDC, you know, the program, it did have some hiccups, but the CDC considered the program really successful. I went back into, you know, the archives of reports from those days, and the Associated Press reported, like back in the 80s, that that program helped 7.7 million people live in rat-free neighborhoods. But the program was eliminated by President Reagan, just because, you know, that was the era of cuts of those, you know, sort of public health programs at the CDC. That wasn't the only program that Reagan cut, and it was just never picked back up again. So what I write is that, you know, perhaps this is something that's growing to be a problem of such magnitude where it is sort of a public health problem across the nation, because so many Americans live in cities. It's a problem that's being caused in part by climate change, which is a national problem. The U.S. is the biggest, you know, contributor historically of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. So this is a problem that's partially caused by the nation as a whole. So, you know, I argue in the piece that perhaps it's time to start looking at some sort of federal grant program to help cities deal with this problem.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That's Emily Atkins, staff writer at the New Republic. She joined us to talk about how warmer weather is playing a role in the rising rat population in urban areas and what efforts are being taken to manage it.
Coming up after the news, we want to hear from you. Do you think it's harder to make close friends when you're over 30? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the Trump administration recently signaled a rollback to Obama-era policies about campus sexual assault. We'll talk with the author of a new book about what this change could mean for students and for schools.
First, when you're in your 30s and 40s, there are a lot of new people in your life through work, kids' play dates, maybe social media, but a lot of people find that it's hard to make close friends as an adult.
And what about you? Do you think that's true? Do you agree? Have you maybe struggled to make new friends now that you're over 30? You can call us right now at 800-642-1234 and tell us what you think. What do you try to do to meet new people when you're all grown up? And why do you think it is so hard to find the kinds of connections you used to make more easily when you were younger? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Marla Paul is the author of The Friendship Crisis, Finding, Making, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore. She's also the health sciences editor at Northwestern University. Marla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you wrote this book a few years back. What inspired you to write this? What were you seeing out there?
Well, I had grown up in Chicago and lived in Dallas for a while and moved back to Chicago, and my life had changed. I'd always been a staff writer for a newspaper, but I was moving back to Chicago with a young baby, and I was freelancing. I no longer had the people around me in an office that, you know, I could, you know, hang out with. And I wasn't worried. I just thought, well, you know, I've never had a problem before. I'll just make friends in my neighborhood. I'll make friends with, you know, the parents of my daughter's schoolmates. And I sure tried, but it didn't happen. And, you know, people never had time to get together. And I just didn't, you know, find good, you know, good matches with my the parents of my daughter's friends. And I started to get really discouraged and started to think there was something wrong with me, you know, that I had some glaring flaw. And I wrote an essay about it and kind of confessing, you know, feeling kind of ashamed and embarrassed that this was my situation. And I just, there was an outpouring of response from readers at the Chicago Tribune at the time saying, you know, oh my God, this has happened to me. You know, you're not the only one. And then I wrote about it for a national magazine. And this time I heard from women around the country, you know, who'd had the same experience. So I really felt like there was something going on, you know, in the country and, you know, in our current climate of busyness. And that's, you know, that's what motivated me to write the book.
It seems like there is a sweet spot, maybe when we're in our 20s, where it seems like friends are falling off trees. And sometimes it feels like you have more to do with than you know how to do. And some it's just attach themselves to you. And then there are other times of life, seems like later when they fall away and you look around and you go, where'd everybody go? I mean, what is it about that transition that changes like that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think my daughter is in the stage where friends are pretty much falling off trees. You know, she's in her late 20s, just moved to a new city, and it just makes friends very easily. But there's a certain point, you know, maybe in your early 30s, where your life starts to solidify. You know, you may be getting married, maybe you're having, you know, children, and you're just not as fluid. You know, you've got more responsibilities. Your time isn't as open, and I think that sort of the you know, the natural movement, you know, maybe, you know, in your jobs, it's just there's less, you know, there's less availability of people and less time and less openness, and it becomes harder to make new friends.
And it's, you know, as a kindergarten kid, it seems okay to walk up and say to somebody, will you be my friend? As a 30 to 50 year old, that seems a bit more awkward. Like, is there a right way for people to try to do this, to try to start friend making again?
It's extremely awkward, and it's almost like dating, and it feels strange. I think the easiest and most natural way to make new friends is sort of organically, you know, whether you know, people that you tend to see on a regular basis, and you can get to know them slowly. But that's not always possible, and so it's important to be willing to take a risk. And you meet somebody you like standing in line at the library and say, hey, you know, it would be fun to hang out. Would you like to get coffee sometime? And you have to put yourself out there. And I've done that. And, you know, and it sometimes you maybe get shot down or it doesn't work out. But you can make friends that way. So it's you know, keeping your eyes open for people who are potential, and also putting yourself in situations where you're going to see the same people on a regular basis, and it can be more natural, whether, you know, it's a cycling club or a book club or, you know, if you're a woman being in the PTA, it's, you know, whatever your passion, it's easier to make friends when you get to know people slowly.
We're talking with Marla Paul right now. She's the author of The Friendship Crisis, Finding, Making, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore, talking about the difficulty of making friends when you're in your 30s, when you're not someone who's in that really friend-rich period of life of your 20s and younger sometimes. And Marla, I had a friend who moved to California with a young child, and then she had another. She didn't know anybody, and she said they told her the couple of people she met said, you actually have to have business cards. And when you meet someone, give them a business card and make sure you follow up on that, almost you know, professionalizing it. Is that something that you're seeing, or are people shying away from that kind of aggressive friend making?
Well, I actually heard about the business card thing, and somebody I interviewed for my book actually had those and passed them out to people, you know, because she wanted to find a walking buddy. So are people being more aggressive about it? I hope so. I hope they are, because I think it takes a certain amount of, you know, proactive behavior to make friends, because, you know, people just don't linger the way they used to, you know, after a meeting. And it's you know, we're very scheduled, you know, as we get older, and people become more rigid in their friendship circles, and they think, well, I've got enough friends, I don't have time for anybody else. You know, one of the women I interviewed had also recently moved to a new town and made some overtures to somebody, you know, and the woman said to her, you know, I really like you, but I don't have time for any more friends. So, which I think is a big mistake, because, you know, friends are, you know, some friends last forever, but there's a lot of movement in friendship. And, you know, people move, people, you can have fallings out with people. And I think you always have to be open to new people. It's enriching. And it's, you know, I think you're poorer if you don't stay open to new friendships.
Let's bring in our callers now. We've got Margie on the line in Rockland. Margie, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what do you want to tell us about, Margie?
Well, I think you can make friends at all ages. Excuse me, I have a little allergy, or I've been outside working and got my throat ticklish. But I'm 71, and I have loads of friends. And you just have to stay involved in life. My daughters are teachers. Now I have friends of all ages. I have little people friends and big people friends. And I'm so busy. You meet people when you volunteer for places. And when your children are teachers, you're always involved in lots of things. Now, I have been fortunate to live in the same area. So I haven't experienced having to move a lot over the years. But I just think you have to, you know, the old thing, adaptability is a sign of maturity. You have to adapt to your surroundings and make friends.
Margie, thanks a lot for the call. So staying involved is Margie's secret, it sounds like, Marla. Easier to do, I think, maybe after retirement, but there's a lesson there for people of all ages, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think being involved, as she said, in life and volunteering is important. And, you know, living in the same town is a real boon, because you've had these friends for years, and it's much more difficult to start from scratch.
I wanted to ask you about that, because we've been hearing more about how Americans are getting lonelier. There's Robert Putnam's book about bowling alone, and
right,
people move. They go after jobs, and so they don't have those lifelong connections
right
that a lot of people like Margie have. So do you think that's contributing to all this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, we're very mobile, and that, you know, rips up our roots and the friends that we built these relationships with. You know, certainly, being on email helps, on social media helps. You stay connected with people, but there's no substitute for, you know, sitting across the table from somebody and having lunch together. So I do think that presents a lot of challenges.
Margie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jake up in northern Wisconsin. Jake, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jake?
I just remember when I was younger in high school, I always had a hard time making friends. And like the guest said, in your 20s, you start making friends all over the place. But now that I'm in my 30s, I make friends very slowly, and they're very, very close, but they're very few and far between.
Jake, thanks a lot. So maybe more quality but less quantity there, Marla. Is that a common phenomenon for people in their 30s and 40s?
I do. I do think there's a certain paring down, when you're younger, it's just like you can be friends with everybody and you go out in large groups. But as your time becomes more limited, then you really look at your relationships and say, you know, who's really important to you? You know, whose company do you get pleasure from? Who's a supportive friend? And, you know, fewer can be better.
We're talking to Marla Paul right now. She's the author of The Friendship Crisis: Making, Finding, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a hard time making new friends as you hit age 30 or over? Why do you think that is? Do you think, do you do anything special to try to meet new adult friends? What is that to work? How's that worked? What's your experience been like? Do you have any tips for making new friends as an adult? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And right now we're picking up the conversation about why it's hard to make friends when you're over 30. Marla Paul is with us. She's the author of the book, The Friendship Crisis: Making, Finding, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble making friends as an adult, staying in touch with old friends as you go into your 30s, 40s, and beyond? Why is it difficult, or what has worked for you? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Let's go now to Allie. Allie's with us from Appleton. Allie, hi.
Hi.
What is your story?
So what I have found, so I'm a childless adult in my 30s. So not having that ability to make play dates and things like that with other parents, it's definitely a hindrance on my ability to make new friends, because I don't have those children where I can, you know, set play dates to go to the park or to, you know, little Tommy's birthday party. So especially in a time where you're seeing less and less children, like people are having less children mm-hmm. these days. So.
Right. Allie, thanks for that. And, you know, there is a new world I've heard and experienced when you have kids. But then on the flip side of that, there was a Louis C.K. quote in this New York Times article about how, you know, maybe you didn't necessarily choose these people. Your kids chose them, but you're kind of stuck with it. So what do you think about the kid factor, Marla?
You know, it's funny. My experience was that I didn't feel, you know, a connection with the, you know, the parents of my children's friends. And just because you're in the school and there's a lot of people that you're encountering who have children the same age as your children doesn't necessarily mean that these are people who are, you know, going to be your soulmates or that you want to be friends with. So, yes, it does present, you know, a more of an opportunity, you know, when you, you know, go on a play date or pick your kids up at somebody's house. But it's, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a gold mine. But I can see how it's more challenging, certainly if you're a single woman and without children, and a lot of your friends are having kids and are married and are busy, you know, with their families. And, yeah, I think it's hard.
Thanks for that call, and good luck. We'll go next to Carol on the line and Nina. Carol, hi.
Hi. I think geography is huge. If you move more than 100 miles away from your hometown where you grew up, you're just not going to have weekly or monthly get-togethers with your old friends. And Facebook, looking at Facebook, that's not the same thing as having, you know, social interaction. It can be very lonely. And, of course, family is the same thing. It makes for loneliness. But I find that joining small groups at church or, like, I love book clubs. And, of course, you can't just walk up to people and ask if you can belong to their book club. But what you can do is go to your local library, and they most likely have an organized book club that's held at the library that you can attend and then hopefully make friends that way. So there are some other ways. But I think it's difficult when you move and when you're older. And then, of course, spouse compatibility, too. You want to make sure that your spouse kind of likes the person too. So, it definitely gets harder as you get older, but we got to keep trying because we're social animals.
Carol, thanks a lot for the advice there. Marla, seeking out that local book club is a good first step.
I think it's a terrific idea. And, you know, there's walking groups, and there's, you know, looking into some of these groups that are already in existence is, you know, can be very fruitful. And something else you can do is even try to start a group. I mean, I did that, and it takes some effort, but that's another way to meet like-minded people and people that are also looking for connections. So, and you know, she mentioned the spouse thing. That's especially tricky. You know, that's a whole nother level. I think it's extra hard to find two people that are compatible with two other people.
Right. Yeah. How do you navigate that? It's kind of like, you know, you're double dating, and everybody has to like each other, so the odds, it gets even harder.
Yeah, it's tricky, but, you know, I think you're never going to love both people, you know, but I think if you can just kind of get along and enjoy their company, you just have to kind of be flexible. You know, certainly, you know, maybe your husband will have a male friend, and you can get along with the wife, you know, for a couple hours at dinner. So I think it's just sort of being open to doing that. And when you, all four of you, like each other a lot, that's like winning the lottery.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about the challenges of making friends as an adult, say 30s on up. Marla Paul is with us. She's the author of the book, The Friendship Crisis. Back to your calls now. Jerry is on the line in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Oh, hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm Terry from Waukesha.
Terry, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We, my wife and I we're kind of in that latter stage of life that you've been talking about, and we're extremely lucky. At age 65, we've got a terrific group of old friends. I've been friends with them since college, All of our wives are good friends. Our children have become good friends. It's like a gigantic family. We get together pretty regularly, even though we're scattered about the Midwest. And so we're thinking of moving at least half of the year. These friends are irreplaceable. Moving 1,800 miles to the West Coast, our biggest concern is that we will lose touch with our oldest friends and struggle to make new friends. And I'm wondering if there's anything in your research that it's actually easier at that certain age with volunteer activities, as you've talked about, and book clubs and gardening and all of that. Might it actually be easier without all of the other baggage to make friends? At least that's the theory I'm trying to work with.
All right, Marla, any advice or encouragement for Jerry as he prepares to snowbird?
You know, it's interesting because Jerry, I did talk to, you know, some psychologists and who felt that at a certain stage of life when you're no longer, you know, raising your kids and you're retired, there is more time for friendship. And so I think that, you know, is potentially going to make it easier if you move to meet people. Also, depending on where you go, there could be a lot of people that have recently moved. You know, there's, you know, more, especially in the Sun Belt, you know, more, you know, newcomers, and they'll be open to making more friends. When I had moved to Dallas, originally from Chicago, there were a lot of people coming in and going out, and it was pretty easy to make friends there. So you could have an easier time than you think.
Well, Terry, thanks to you and good luck. And let's take another call here from Chris in Baraboo. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was just that I moved to Mass 2 years ago, and I used meetup.com as a website for people who are into biking or, you know, rock climbing, any kind of activity, really.
Mm-hmm.
And
work.
I didn't actually meet, like, a long-term friend, but it was entertaining. I did it a few times. I met people. It was fun. Like I said, I didn't have any long-term friends from it, but it was a good way to get out there and just meet new people and, you know, see what it's all about, and people who also like your hobbies, you know?
Yeah, that seems like a good way to go. And so did you end up, Chris, making the friends you were looking for somewhere else outside of Meetup?
My girlfriend ended up moving in with me. So we did long distance, and then she moved in with me. So now I have a girlfriend here. So it's a little
so now you don't need friends.
Than being alone. But yeah, that was my real reasoning.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, meetup.com. There's some online tools now. And Marla, I've even heard of one. I can't remember what it's called, Friend Finder or something, where you can type in people who are looking for friends close to you. I mean, this is a real thing, and people are trying to find tech solutions sometimes.
And why not? Why not? You know, you look at all these dating sites. Why shouldn't there be sites for finding friends? It's certainly, you know, as important. You know, there's one thing just to mention is how important friendship is to your mental and physical health. I was fascinated by the research I did on how people with friends don't get sick as much, have stronger immune systems, live longer. It protects your mental health. I mean, your wounds you heal faster, you sleep better. You know, it has a very profound effect on you.
Mm.
Well, Marla, as we wrap up, as with your original article, we've gotten a huge response to this conversation. Do you see things getting better? Is this a problem that we're starting to figure out how to solve?
Well, one thing I see happening is there's more of a conversation about it. You know, when I started, you know, kind of the when I opened it up, you know, at least in my essay at the Tribune, it was still kind of like a secret. And I think that people are much more open about it now, and it's okay to talk about it. So I think that's a good thing. And there's also been more acknowledgement and more research on the importance of friendship. So I think that's all very positive.
And Marla, just real quick, in a couple seconds here, do you think it is possible still to make these close friends in the time we have? Can we do it? Give us a pep talk.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And if I had written a follow-up to my book, I would have said, yes, you can do it. I've done it. You just have to be patient with the process. It takes time, but people are out there, and they want to be your friend. You just have to find them and cast a wide net.
That's a very encouraging note to end on, Marla. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Veronica.
That's Marla Paul, author of The Friendship Crisis, Finding, Making, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore. She also is the health sciences editor at Northwestern University. Thanks for sharing all of your stories and thoughts as well. And by the way, you can keep the conversation going, share your experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
always on the lookout for exotic animals on the loose around Wisconsin here on Central Time. And we've talked before about the Milwaukee lion. I really wish the Milwaukee lion would be sighted again, actually. That was a cool one. And the alleged giant snake sighting crossing a highway in Grant County.
And this morning, we saw the story of the Kenosha County kangaroo.
That's right. The Kenosha County Sheriff's Office reported that it had responded to a call about a kangaroo on the loose on Highway L in the village of Summers.
Turns out it was not a prank call. There was indeed a kangaroo on the loose on the streets. Joey, the kangaroo, was owned by a local farmer. Looks like it may have escaped by kicking out the gate of its confine, which is how I would imagine a kangaroo escape going down, actually.
And the sheriff's office quote says, 5-year-old Joey the kangaroo was safely returned to the farm without any injury to anyone.
So that's good news. You know, if I saw like a mountain lion or a snake, I could, you know, I might be freaked out, but I would accept the evidence of my senses. If I saw a kangaroo on the streets of Wisconsin, I think I would doubt my perception at that point.
It would be really cool, though. And there are pictures online. If you look this up, Joey the kangaroo, he's really cute. And I think I would rather see a kangaroo than what they saw. There was this headline, a tiger on the loose walking down the highway in Atlanta last week.
Wow. So this kangaroo could be our friend. This is Central Time.
Do you come from a land down under?